2. The house, which Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch had reached, stood alone in a deserted lane between fences, beyond which market gardens stretched at the very end of the town. It was a very solitary little wooden house, which was only just built and not yet weatherboarded. In one of the little windows, the shutters were not yet closed, and there was a candle standing on the window ledge, evidently as a signal to the late guest who was expected that night. 30 paces away, Stavrogin made out on the doorstep the figure of a tall man, evidently the master of the house, who had come out to stare impatiently up the road. He heard his voice, too, impatient and, as it were, timid.
"Is that you? You?"
"Yes," responded Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, but not till he had mounted the steps and was folding up his umbrella.
"At last, sir."
Captain Lebyadkin, for it was he, ran fussily to and fro.
"Let me take your umbrella, please. It's very wet. I'll open it on the floor here in the corner. Please, walk in. Please walk in."
The door was opened from the passage into a room that was lighted by 2 candles.
"If it had not been for your promise that you would certainly come, I should have given up expecting you."
"A 1:15, said Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, looking at his watch as he went into the room.
"And in this rain, and such an interesting distance. I've no clock, and there are nothing but market gardens round me, so that you fall behind the times. Not that I murmur exactly, for I dare not, but only because I've been devoured with impatience all the week to have things settled at last."
"How so?"
"Dear my fate, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, please sit down."
He bowed, pointing to a seat by the table before the sofa. Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch looked round. The room was tiny and low-pitched. The furniture consisted only of the most essential articles, plain wooden chairs and a sofa, also newly made without covering or cushions. There were 2 tables of limewood, one by the sofa, and the other in the corner was covered with a tablecloth laid with things over which a clean table napkin had been thrown. And indeed, the whole room was obviously kept extremely clean. Captain Lebyadkin had not been drunk for 8 days. His face looked bloated and yellow. His eyes looked uneasy, inquisitive, and obviously bewildered. It was only too evident that he did not know what tone he could adopt, and what line it would be most advantageous for him to take.
"Here," he indicated his surroundings, "I live like Zosima. Sobriety, solitude, and poverty. The vow of the knights of old."
"You imagine that the knights of old took such vows?"
"Perhaps I'm mistaken. Alas, I have no culture. I've ruined all. Believe me, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, here first I have recovered from shameful propensities. Not a glass nor a drop. I have a home, and for 6 days past I have experienced a conscience at ease. Even the walls smell of resin and remind me of nature. And what have I been? What was I? At night, without a bed, I wander, and my tongue put out by day. To use the words of a poet of genius. You're wet through, though. Wouldn't you like some tea?"
"Don't trouble.
The samovar has been boiling since 8 o'clock, but it went out at last, like everything in this world. The sun, too, they say, will go out in its turn. But if you like, I'll get up the samovar. Agafya is not asleep."
"Tell me, Maria Timofeyevna?"
"She's here,"
Lebyadkin replied at once in a whisper.
"Would you like to have a look at her?"
He pointed to the closed door to the next room.
"She's not asleep." "Oh, no, no. How could she be? On the contrary, she's been expecting you all the evening, and as soon as she heard you were coming, she began making her toilet."
He was just twisting his mouth into a jocose smile, but he instantly checked himself. "How is she on the whole?" asked Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, frowning.
"On the whole? You know that yourself, sir."
He shrugged his shoulders commiseratingly.
"But just now she's telling her fortune with cards.
Very good. Later on. First of all, I must finish with you. Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch settled himself in a chair. The captain did not venture to sit down on the sofa, but at once moved up another chair for himself and bent forward to listen in a tremor of expectation. "What have you got there under the tablecloth?" asked Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, suddenly noticing it. "That," said Lebyadkin, turning towards it also, "that's from your generosity, by way of housewarming, so to say. Considering also the length of the walk and your natural fatigue." He sniggered ingratiatingly. Then he got up on tiptoe, and respectfully and carefully lifted the tablecloth from the table in the corner. Under it was seen a slight meal. Ham, veal, sardines, cheese, a little green decanter, and a long bottle of Bordeaux. Everything had been laid neatly, expertly, and almost daintily.
"Was that your effort?"
"Yes, sir. Ever since yesterday I've done my best, and all to do you honour. Marya Timofeyevna doesn't trouble herself, as you know, on that score. And what's more, it's all from your liberality, your own providing, as you're the master of this house and not I, and I'm only, so to say, your agent. All the same, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, all the same, in spirit, I'm independent. Don't take away from me this last possession," he finished up pathetically.
"Hmm. You might sit down again."
"Grateful, grateful, and independent."
He sat down.
"Ah, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, so much has been fermenting in this heart that I have not known how to wait for your coming. Now you will decide my fate, and that unhappy creature's. And then, shall I pour out all I feel to you as I used to in the old days, 4 years ago? You deigned to listen to me then. You read my verses. They might call me your Falstaff from Shakespeare in those days. But you meant so much in my life. I have great terrors now, and it's only to you I look for counsel and light. Pyotr Stepanovich is treating me abominably."
Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch listened with interest and looked at him attentively. It was evident that though Captain Lebyadkin had left off drinking, he was far from being in a harmonious state of mind. Drunkards of many years' standing, like Lebyadkin, often show traces of incoherence, of mental cloudiness, of something, as it were, damaged and crazy, though they may deceive, cheat, and swindle almost as well as anybody if occasion arises.
"I see that you haven't changed a bit in these 4 years and more, Captain," said Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, somewhat more amiably. "It seems, in fact, as though the second half of a man's life is usually made up of nothing but the habits he has accumulated during the first half."
"Grand words! You solve the riddle of life," said the captain, half cunningly, half in genuine and unfeigned admiration, for he was a great lover of words. "Of all your sayings, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, I remember one thing above all. You were in Petersburg when you said it. One must really be a great man to be able to make a stand even against common sense. That was it."
"Yes, and a fool as well."
"A fool as well, maybe. But you've been scattering clever sayings all your life, while they... Imagine Liputin. Imagine Pyotr Stepanovich saying anything like that. Oh, how cruelly Pyotr Stepanovich has treated me."
"But how about yourself, Captain? What can you say of your behaviour?"
"Drunkenness and the multitude of my enemies. But now that's all over. All over. And I have a new skin, like a snake. Do you know, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, I am making my will. In fact, I've made it already."
"That's interesting. What are you leaving, and to whom?"
"To my fatherland, to humanity, and to the students. Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, I read in the paper the biography of an American. He left all his vast fortune to factories and to the exact sciences, and his skeleton to the students of the academy there, and his skin to be made into a drum so that the American national hymn might be beaten upon it day and night. Alas, we are pygmies in mind compared with the soaring thoughts of the states of North America. Russia is the play of nature, but not of mind. If I were to try leaving my skin for a drum, for instance, to the Akhmolinsky Infantry Regiment in which I had the honour of beginning my service on condition of beating the Russian national hymn upon it every day in the face of the regiment, they'd take it for liberalism and prohibit my skin. So I confine myself to the students. I want to leave my skeleton to the academy. But on the condition, though, on the condition that a label should be stuck on the forehead forever and ever, with the words, "A repentant free thinker." There now.
The captain spoke excitedly, and genuinely believed, of course, that there was something fine in the American will. But he was cunning, too, and very anxious to entertain Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, with whom he had played the part of a buffoon for a long time in the past. But the latter did not even smile. On the contrary, he asked, as it were, suspiciously, "So you intend to publish your will in your lifetime and get rewarded for it?"
"And what if I do, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch? What if I do?" said Lebyadkin, watching him carefully. "What sort of luck have I had? I've given up writing poetry, and at one time even you were amused by my verses, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch. Do you remember our reading them over a bottle? But it's all over with my pen. I've written only one poem, like Gogol's, The Last Story. Do you remember? He proclaimed to Russia that it broke spontaneously from his bosom. It's the same with me. I've sung my last and it's over."
"What sort of poem?"
"In case she were to break her leg."
"What?" That was all the captain was waiting for. He had an unbounded admiration for his own poems, but, through a certain cunning duplicity, he was pleased, too, that Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch always made merry over his poems, and sometimes laughed at them immoderately. In this way he killed two birds with one stone, satisfying at once his poetical aspirations and his desire to be of service. But now he had a third, special, and very ticklish object in view. Bringing his verses on the scene, the captain thought to exculpate himself on one point about which, for some reason, he always felt himself most apprehensive and most guilty.
"In case of her breaking her leg, that is, of her riding on horseback, it's a fantasy, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, a wild fancy, but the fancy of a poet. One day I was struck by meeting a lady on horseback, and asked myself the vital question, what would happen then, that is, in case of accident? All her followers turn away, all her suitors are gone, a pretty kettle of fish. Only the poet remains faithful, with his heart shattered in his breast, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch. Even a louse may be in love, and is not forbidden by law. And yet the lady was offended by the letter and the verses. I'm told that even you were angry. Were you? I wouldn't believe in anything so grievous. Whom could I harm simply by imagination? Besides, I swear on my honour, Liputin kept saying, 'Send it, send it. Every man, however humble, has a right to send a letter.' And so I sent it."
"You offered yourself as a suitor, I understand."
"Enemies, enemies, enemies."
"Repeat the verses," said Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch sternly.
"Ravings, ravings more than anything."
However, he drew himself up, stretched out his hand, and began.
"With broken limbs, my beauteous queen is twice as charming as before, and deep in love as I have been, today I love her even more."
"Come, that's enough," said Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, a wave of his hand.
"A dream of Petersburg,"
cried Lebyadkin, passing quickly to another subject, as though there had been no mention of verses.
"I dream of regeneration, benefactor. May I reckon that you won't refuse the means for the journey? I've been waiting for you all the week as my sunshine."
"I'll do nothing of the sort. I've scarcely any money left. And why should I give you money?"
Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch seemed suddenly angry. Dryly and briefly, he recapitulated all the captain's misdeeds, his drunkenness, his lying, his squandering of the money meant for Marya Timofyevna, his having taken her from the nunnery, his insolent letters threatening to publish the secret, the way he had behaved about Darya Pavlovna, and so on and so on. The captain heaved, gesticulated, began to reply, but every time Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch stopped him peremptorily.
"And listen," he observed at last, "you keep writing about family disgrace. What disgrace is it to you that your sister is the lawful wife of a Stavrogin?"
"But marriage in secret, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, a fatal secret. I receive money from you, and I'm suddenly asked the question, what's that money for? My hands are tied. I cannot answer to the detriment of my sister, to the detriment of the family honour."
The captain raised his voice. He liked that subject, and reckoned boldly upon it. Alas, he did not realise what a blow was in store for him. Calmly and exactly, as though he was speaking of the most everyday arrangement, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch informed him that in a few days, perhaps even tomorrow or the day after, he intended to make his marriage known everywhere, to the police as well as to local society. And so the question of family honour would be settled once for all, and with it the question of subsidy. The captain's eyes were ready to drop out of his head. He positively could not take it in. It had to be explained to him.
"But she is crazy."
"I shall make suitable arrangements."
"But how about your mother?"
"Well, she must do as she likes."
"But will you take your wife to your house?"
"Perhaps so. But that is absolutely nothing to do with you, and no concern of yours."
"No concern of mine?" cried the captain. "What about me, then?"
"Well, certainly you won't come into my house."
"But, you know, I'm a relation."
"One does one's best to escape from such relations." "Why should I go on giving you money, then?" "Judge for yourself."
"Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, this is impossible. You will think better of it, perhaps. You don't want to lay hands upon... What will people think? What will the world say?"
"Much I care for your world. I married your sister when the fancy took me, after a drunken dinner for a bet, and now I'll make it public, since that amuses me now." He said this with a peculiar irritability, so that Lebyadkin began with horror to believe him.
"But me? Me? What about me? I'm what matters most. Perhaps you're joking, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch."
"No, I'm not joking."
"As you will, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, but I don't believe you." "Then I'll take proceedings."
"You're fearfully stupid, Captain."
"Maybe. But this is all that's left me," said the captain, losing his head completely. "In old days, we used to get free quarters anyway for the work she did in the corners. But what will happen now if you throw me over altogether?"
"But you want to go to Petersburg to try a new career. By the way, is it true what I hear, that you mean to go and give information in the hope of obtaining a pardon by betraying all the others?" The captain stood gaping with wide open eyes and made no answer.
"Listen, Captain," Stavrogin began suddenly with great earnestness, bending down to the table. Until then he had been talking, as it were, ambiguously, so that Lebyadkin, who had wide experience in playing the part of buffoon, was up to the last moment a trifle uncertain whether his patron were really angry or simply putting it on, whether he really had the wild intention of making his marriage public, or whether he were only playing. Now Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch's stern expression was so convincing that a shiver ran down the captain's back.
"Listen, and tell the truth, Lebyadkin. Have you betrayed anything yet or not? Have you succeeded in doing anything, really? Have you sent a letter to somebody in your foolishness?"
"No, I haven't. And I haven't thought of doing it," said the captain, looking fixedly at him.
"That's a lie that you haven't thought of doing it. That's what you're asking to go to Petersburg for. If you haven't written, have you blabbed to anybody here? Speak the truth. I've heard something."
"When I was drunk, to Liputin. Liputin's a traitor. I opened my heart to him," whispered the poor captain.
"That's all very well, but there's no need to be an ass. If you had an idea, you should have kept it to yourself. Sensible people hold their tongues nowadays. They don't go chattering."
"Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch," said the captain, quaking, "you've had nothing to do with it yourself. It's not you I've—"
"Yes, you wouldn't have ventured to kill the goose that laid your golden eggs."
"Judge for yourself, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, judge for yourself."
And in despair, with tears, the captain began hurriedly relating the story of his life for the last 4 years. It was the most stupid story of a fool, drawn into matters that did not concern him, and in his drunkenness and debauchery, unable till the last minute to grasp their importance. He said that before he left Petersburg he had been drawn in, at first simply through friendship, like a regular student, although he wasn't a student, and, knowing nothing about it, without being guilty of anything, he had scattered various papers on staircases, left them by dozens at doors, on bell handles, had thrust them in as though they were newspapers, taken them to the theatre, put them in people's hats, and slipped them into pockets. Afterwards, he had taken money from them.
"For what means had I?"
He had distributed all sorts of rubbish through the districts of two provinces.
"Oh, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch," he exclaimed. "What revolted me most was that this was utterly opposed to civic, and still more to patriotic laws. They suddenly printed that men were to go out with pitchforks, and to remember that those who went out poor in the morning might go home rich at night. Only think of it. It made me shudder. And yet I distributed it. Or suddenly, 5 or 6 lines addressed to the whole of Russia, apropos of nothing. 'Make haste and lock up the churches, abolish God, do away with marriage, destroy the right of inheritance, take up your knives.' That's all. And God knows what it means, I tell you. I almost got caught with this 5-line leaflet. The officers in the regiment gave me a thrashing, but bless them for it, let me go. And last year I was almost caught when I passed off French counterfeit notes for 50 rubles on Karafayev. But, thank God, Karafayev fell into the pond when he was drunk and was drowned in the nick of time, and they didn't succeed in tracking me. Here, at Virginsky's, I proclaimed the freedom of the communistic wife. In June I was distributing manifestos again in X district. They say they will make me do it again. Pyotr Stepanovich suddenly gave me to understand that I must obey. He's been threatening me a long time. How he treated me that Sunday! Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, I am a slave. I am a worm, but not a god, which is where I differ from Dershavin. But I've no income, no income."
Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch heard it all with curiosity. "A great deal of that I had heard nothing of," he said. "Of course, anything may have happened to you. Listen," he said, after a moment's thought, "if you like, you can tell them, you know whom, that Liputin was lying, and that you were only pretending to give information to frighten me, supposing that I too was compromised, and that you might get more money out of me that way. Do you understand?"
"Dear Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, is it possible that there's such a danger hanging over me? I've been longing for you to come to ask you."
Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch laughed. "They certainly wouldn't let you go to Petersburg.
even if I were to give you money for the journey. But it's time for me to see Maria Timofeyevna. And he got up from his chair.
Nikolai Vsyevolodovich, but how about Maria Timofeyevna?
Why, as I told you.
Can it be true?
You still don't believe it.
Will you really cast me off like an old worn-out shoe?
I'll see, laughed Nikolai Vsyevolodovich. Come, let me go.
Wouldn't you like me to stand on the steps, for fear I might by chance overhear something, for the rooms are small?
That's as well. Stand on the steps. Take my umbrella.
Your umbrella? Am I worth it?
Said the captain, oversweetly. Anyone is worthy of an umbrella.
At one stroke, you define the minimum of human rights.
But he was by now muttering mechanically. He was too much crushed by what he had learned, and was completely thrown out of his reckoning. And yet, almost as soon as he had gone out onto the steps and had put up the umbrella, there his shallow and cunning brain caught again the ever-present comforting idea that he was being cheated and deceived, and if so, they were afraid of him, and there was no need for him to be afraid.
If they're lying and deceiving me, what's at the bottom of it?
Was the thought that gnawed at his mind. The public announcement of the marriage seemed to him absurd.
It's true that with such a wonder-worker, anything may come to pass. He lives to do harm. But what if he's afraid himself, since the insult of Sunday, and afraid as he's never been before, and so he's in a hurry to declare that he'll announce it himself, from fear that I should announce it, eh? Don't blunder, Lebyadkin. And why does he come on the sly at night if he means to make it public himself? And if he's afraid, it means that he's afraid now, at this moment, for these few days. Eh, don't make a mistake, Lebyadkin. He scares me with Pyotr Stepanovich. Oi, I'm frightened. Yes, this is what's so frightening. And what induced me to blab to Liputin? Goodness knows what these devils are up to. I can never make head or tail of it. Now they are all astir again as they were 5 years ago. To whom could I give information, indeed? Haven't I written to anyone in my foolishness? So then I might write as though through foolishness. Isn't he giving me a hint? You're going to Petersburg on purpose, the sly rogue. I've scarcely dreamed of it. And he guesses my dreams, as though he were putting me up to going himself. It's one or the other of two games he's up to. Either he's afraid because he's been up to some pranks himself, or he's not afraid for himself, but is simply egging me on to give them all away. Ah, it's terrible, Lebyadkin. Ah, you must not make a blunder.
He was so absorbed in thought that he forgot to listen. It was not easy to hear, either. The door was a solid one, and they were talking in a very low voice. Nothing reached the captain but indistinct sounds. He positively spat in disgust, and went out again, lost in thought, to whistle on the steps.